Who's interviewing who this time? Are we interviewing each
Let's
other?
just have a chat. Let's just
All
have a
right, it's
chat.
this. All right, sounds good.
All righty. Okay, this is Deanna Spingola. It is Monday, June 10th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Jan Irvin, IRVIN. His website is gnosticmedia.com, and I had him on my RBN program a couple of weeks ago and enjoyed chatting with him tremendously and thought, well, let's do this again. But minus the commercials.
Indeed. Well, Deanna, it's so nice to talk to another researcher who is actually interested in, primary facts and documentation and not just, what they channel or to think positive and dismiss stuff, So it's always nice to come across researchers who are serious about their work and are interested in details. So I was really happy to be interviewed by you a couple of weeks ago. And what's funny is I've had you on my list to interview for probably a year or two. And it's good that something finally brought us together. It's like recently William Ingdahl and I were brought together, and I've been meaning to interview him, and I even had him on my list talking about interviewing him maybe a year and a half or two ago. I've got two of his books literally sitting on the shelf just out of arm's reach from me right here. And
Which
then
ones do you have? Which books do you have?
The Century of War and Gods of Money.
Oh, uh-huh.
And
Yeah, I have those too.
so here they're sitting here, and I haven't gotten a chance to read him or interview him. And then through somebody else, he contacts me last week, and we just spoke today, and he's like, hey, I really like the research on Wasson and everything that you've been doing, and he sent me some leads of research this morning. And so it's like all of these different paths coming together that I've been trying to figure out the time to get together already.
Sure. Well, I think people naturally just find each other. They gravitate to other people who believe and are doing the same kinds of things, and so it's just kind of a natural progression that we would meet. And of course, we
Right.
have a mutual friend, Clint Richardson, who I just absolutely love. He's a terrific person and a good friend,
Yeah,
and.
I was supposed to talk. Oh no, I did talk to him last night, but his mom visited and then our whole conversation was thrown off. So I think I'm supposed to talk to him today too. It's gonna be one of those days, like my throat is already like 3 hours in today. So if I get raspy, forgive me.
That's all right. So what is your latest project? What are you working on now?
You mean post Manufacturing the Deadhead with Joe Abele?
Right.
Well, right now I'm working on a few different things. One is a new paper called Documenting Wasson. I just spoke with James Corbett last night, about the idea of just exposing more on Aldous Huxley, whether a joint project or individually, and then bringing it together later. Because he's done some work on Aldous Huxley and eugenics, et cetera, in the past as well. And then I was on his show last week. And then I'm also floating around the idea. It's starting to settle in my mind, really, a new article that I'd like to do on Aldous Huxley called Aldous Huxley, A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. So, being that he was a Fabian socialist, right?
Oh, absolutely. He was with a group in London. They were just they had a club. Oh, what was the name of that club that they had that they met?
Which the Fabian Socialists
Right,
or
but there
which?
was a they had a club. It wasn't the Fabian Socialist Club. It was what I just can't think of what they
Let
called
me
it.
see. I'm just looking at my database here, see if I have the club listed here. I don't. I have round table of the Cliveden set.
Nope, something else. And I'm not on the computer that I usually work on. I'm on my interview computer. I'm on my desktop computer up in my office. So I should have transferred some files up here. Well, I mean, I do have some files transferred up here. I'm very obsessive compulsive about
So,
losing things, so I tend to keep a lot of things on external hard drives and various computers.
we see Aldous also at the Century Club. So he's at the Century Club, the Fabian Society. He's one of the people behind Perennial Tradition, working with the Tavistock Institute. And those are the primary ones that I have here as far as clubs. So you might have one more that I don't, that maybe I should get from you,
Yeah.
which is why I've been wanting to talk to you for the last 2 weeks, because you had all of this research and ideas, and I, it's just like speaking to William this morning and realizing that we have all of this overlap and how it might behoove all of us to start, comparing notes, because that's the thing with doing all of this research is when you follow the citations rather than the whims of your heart, then we all kind of end up merging on the same place, and it's like Richard Grove and Kevin Cole over Tragedy and Hope. They both each have their own brain databases, as do I. And even though Kevin has created his database completely separately from either of ours, and both Richard and I, our databases separated out a couple of years ago. And it's amazing how many research points perfectly overlap when we're going through research. We can go, yes, that's the same that I have here, and that's the same you've got there. And so you're on the right path, because you can't get multiple people meeting at the same place going, oh, hey, how did you get here, And then they say, oh, well, I followed the path of research. Well, that's how I got here. So here we are, Deanna.
Exactly. And where that might be, I don't know. I'm actually working on my third book in my
Congratulations.
series, and it's The Ruling Elite. And I was actually geared to finish it and have it out by June of, well, like right now. But you find that when you go down the proverbial rabbit hole, that you find more tunnels than you anticipated,
Oh, sure.
and one truth leads you to another truth,
Deanna,
and
can I give you a tip?
yes,
You just have to let it go and give birth.
oh yes.
The ever-growing book project, it will never stop unless you just give birth to it. Every time I write a book, eventually I just have to draw the line and say, this is where this one stops and this is where the next one begins,
Sure. That's what I was thinking over the weekend. I thought maybe I just need to do this part of it, get it out. But then I find, I find something else that is so relevant. So
Right.
it's
So, and it's like, when I was investigating John Allegra's background and all of the attacks against him by Gordon Wasson and everything, and he was the author of the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross and the famous Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, a part of one of the aid of the original translation team. And of course, they launched this huge attack against him. In my first two books, we focused a lot on Allegra's work. And in the second book, it was all about revealing how all of the attacks against him were launched by Gordon Wasson regarding ethnomycology. And we had gone through and checked every single citation and claim against him, and every single one was false. But it's funny, as I wrote a third book regarding that and all of these interviews that I still haven't published because of all of this new stuff that's come out. And how do we deal with all of the new information surrounding Huxley and Wasson and everything regarding this massive 1,000-page interview book project that I've done. So yeah, it's just what do you do? And then once you have it, when do you release it, and how do you release it?
Right. Indeed. So, back to my initial question. What you're working on Huxley and that group of people, and are you going to put that into a book? What are your intentions on that?
This probably should all be going into a book, but I feel that it's so important that I've just been writing essays and putting them out, which may one day become a book or whatever, you know, if the publisher isn't upset, if it's not me who, you know, whoever publishes it, and I have my own publishing company as well, but a lot of times they don't like stuff to have already been out there. And, but yeah, it probably should get into a book, but at the same time, I feel that the urgency supersedes book format, and then I just try and get it out to the public because of the importance of the matter itself.
Oh, sure. In fact, I was talking to somebody on set on Friday about just that subject, and he's put out a lot of things about a very important subject, one that you have dealt with also, with the music industry and that whole cultural thing in the 1960s. And he is actually going to incorporate all the stuff that he's already put online about the Laurel Canyon things that he's got online.
Sure. Oh, you must be talking about Dave McGowan.
Dave McGowan.
Because he told me that he was working on a book and that he had chapters that he didn't publish, you know, when we talked. We had talked on the phone a couple times.
Uh-huh.
I tried to get him to come on my show, and then he disappeared. So so I'm glad he's still going on your show, but unfortunately he didn't come on mine. All the power to him. But, you know, we're going to keep promoting his work and get people to study it regardless of whether or not he likes it.
Well, I'm sure if you, you know, contact him that he would probably come on your program.
Well, I'll try. I'll reach out to him again this week and see what happens. But yeah, I would love to have him on because we've certainly incorporated his work into ours, and he's got a lot of good stuff there. And I think it all goes together well, just like you're in my research.
Right, right. And, you know, the League of Nations and all the people, there was an American branch of the Fabian Society. It was the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, which later became the Students for a Democratic Society. And they did that, like, in 1905. And that
was... See, you're going over my head here. So, see, this is when you bring up stuff like this, I'm like, wait, get over here, and here's my database. Start putting all of this stuff in, you know, because.
See, I have so many notes and things that, and I bring this stuff up. I did this, one of the chapters in my second book, I believe it was my second book. Let me just see if that's where it was. I believe it was in book two. Yes.
I'm going to share my screen with you here so that you can see the database on the screen here.
Oh,
and
I see.
I have
okay.
Up.
Okay.
So this is where I keep my notes on my research connections.
Okay. Yeah, well, I did this thing. It was called The Parliament of Man. And, subtitled The League of Nations, and it's a chapter in my second book that I talk about the socialist worldwide. It's kind of a worldwide network, and of course all the stuff that goes on in England seems to spill over into this country, and they have their tentacles reaching out, and they have all of these institutes and tax-free associations and agencies, so it is like a great big octopus that has tentacles out in every direction, and they take over so many different already established societies. Well, like the Pilgrim Society and all the foundations, and it is just amazing. And when you start looking into these things and realize that the same financiers are behind it, like the B'nai B'rith. I mean, there's so many
front Andrew
groups.
Carnegie, David Rockefeller is in there, Frank Astral,
sure.
John D. Rockefeller. I mean, yeah, Averill Harriman right there. All these banker guys are right there cross-pollinating these clubs.
Right.
Oh, you know, Henry Luce was also it was Henry Luce the III, I think, that was a member of the Pilgrims. Yes, it was the thirds. No, Henry Luce Sr. Was the Skull and Bones. Henry Luce the III was
Pilgrims.
He was Pilgrims, and he was also from Yale, but he took over. He was actually the president of the Pilgrim Society, Henry Luce the III. That's Henry Luce of Time Life Magazine. That's his son. And then he also later took over Time Life Inc.
Okay, so let's talk about the Pilgrim Society and who is actually every single president since Theodore Roosevelt has been a member of the Pilgrim Society, and every single Secretary of State has been a member of the Pilgrim Society. And it is one of the most secretive societies. And I believe there was only about one book that was written about it.
Well, I have a book called Pilgrims of the United States or Pilgrims of America or something. I have it upstairs. But get this, the librarian of the Century Club turned me on to this book regarding the Pilgrims.
Now, is that by Anne Pimlott Baker?
That could be.
Okay, yeah,
if you,
it's called the
Pilgrims. Give me just a second. Go ahead.
Sure. It's called The Pilgrims of Great Britain, A Centennial History by Anne Pimlott Baker. It's put out by Profile Books in London, England, and the copyright is held by the Pilgrims of Great Britain. It was published in 2002.
Yeah, and then so the Pilgrim Society of America actually comes out of the Pilgrims of Great Britain. And then the Pilgrims of Great Britain was founded by Lord Birkett and Harry Brittain and Allington Castle. Now, the book that I have, yes, that's exactly Anne Pimlott Baker, The Pilgrims of the United States, A Centennial History. So this is the book that I have, and this book was referred to me by the librarian of the Century Club, which is a CIA front.
Right. And it's really the only book that talks specifically about the Pilgrim Society.
Right.
And it actually, the whole idea for it came out of Oxford University and John Ruskin, a Freemason, and he got some of his students together, Arnold Toynbee, Alfred Milner, Arthur Glazebrook, George Parkin, Philip Gell.
Look what I have here. So this is interesting. So, Arthur Balfour was also a member of the Pilgrims of Great Britain. Now, get this. So Lord Northcliffe was a member there. Now, that's the guy who later goes public exposing all of this stuff, and they basically lock him up and they lobotomize him. And then his secretary, the former news correspondent, Douglas Reed, exposed all of that in his book, The Controversy of Zion.
Right. And I'm not, I like his book, The Controversy, but he did another book, The Prisoner of Ottawa, which is very biased. And keep in mind that he is a Brit. And
we shouldn't poison the well, though, between the works, though.
No,
but yeah.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I guess you do have to look at each work that an individual does based on what is in that book and then just
on
not
its individual point-by-point merits.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
And we have to be, that's always something, it's so easy. Well, the fallacy is, it's called poisoning the well, but it's essentially saying that if somebody committed an error once in their lifetime, then essentially everything that they ever say from then on is going to be in error. I mean, even if they're disinformationists, they're still going to be, having to put out some amount of truth at some time about some different points,
Sure.
So, let's see. I was just looking up the poisoning the well fallacy here. So the poisoning the well fallacy, this sort of reasoning involves trying to discredit what a person might later claim by presenting unfavorable information, be it true or false, about the person.
Right.
This argument has the following claim, blah, blah, blah. So there you go.
Yeah, that's a nice core project that you got that from.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And there's what's interesting is they don't apply any of those to their own work, but they just use it to attack others supposedly,
How true.
I think they're using them to teach sophism, because obviously when you memorize these fallacies to, people that use them in a sophist manner, this is how they do that stuff. If you memorize the logical fallacies, you can protect yourself from the people that would, also use them against you. And it actually falls under two different forms of ancient critical thinking, the classical trivium used for mind control and the trivium method used is basically the antithesis of the former.
Right. Yeah, Clint talks about that.
Yeah, he got that from me, and I highly recommend checking it out. It's all about who, what, where, when, why, and how. That's essentially what the trivium is, and they don't want people to know it because it gets you back to trusting yourself and your own five senses and looking things up. You know, because input is who, what, where, and when. Processing is why. Output is how. You can't explain why something is or works or anything without who, what, where, and when first. So if you want to mind control somebody, you just get them to put logic or why before
Exactly.
grammar or who, what, where, and when. So this is what
Yes.
they do, and this is what they condition the children with in compulsory education, et cetera.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just a simple matter, but it stems out of the seven liberal arts. So this the second level of that is the quadrivium. You know, and for your listeners who want to look more into this, my website on all of this is triviumeducation.com,
Oh,
TRI.
that's yours. Okay.
Yes, that's me. And so, but the quadrivium is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. So they'll also take these out of order. You know, for instance, arithmetic is number in itself, geometry is number in space, music is number in time, astronomy is number in space and time. So if you want to mess a kid up, you teach him algebra before geometry, which of course algebra came out of geometry, so it always has to go after geometry. So then when you give a kid algebra first, then they can't understand what they would possibly apply anything they're learning, you know, to any of this stuff. When if they had geometry first, they could just walk outside and look at a tree or a pine cone or a flower or a building or a, you know, a dog or a cat and see the Fibonacci and the golden ratio and all of this stuff and go, aha, this is what I apply it all to, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, it causes intentional befuddlement through the compulsory education system, which, you know, people like John Taylor Gatto and Charlotte Isherbit have
Talk
exposed.
about right now. Give us that website again. Trivium what?
TriviumEducation.com, and that's TRIVIUM education.com.
Okay.
And that's also linked from the Gnostic Media website. If they can't find it, they'll find it over there.
Okay. Yes, I have visited this website when Clint first talked to me about it, oh, probably 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, you know, we're constantly updating and putting new information out. In fact, the top video there is with Kevin Cole and Richard Grove regarding the classical trivium versus the trivium method. So, if people want to find out more between the two on how the classical trivium is used for mind control, I highly recommend that. But basically, the trivium is really how they run their entire operations, and getting people to follow the lies that they tell themselves, rather than just simply going to look things up, you know. And then they get now get everybody caught into this quantum physics stuff that there is no truth, truth is arbitrary. See, logic, which is a second part of the trivium, is the art of non-contradictory identification, whereas this Kabbalistic quantum physics is essentially the art of fitting as many contradictions into one time and space as possible. So once you get that it's all about contradictions, you know, and see, there are no contradictions in nature. There are only contradictions in the mind of man. And so when you find a contradiction, this should alert you that there is a lie there, or you know, a mistake or an error. And you know, we can break it down into subject and predicate. We can go through and remove all of the fallacies. We can figure out what's being said and look at everything in this manner. And then when we derive at a clear, concise conclusion, 1 + 1 = 2, then we know that we've removed all of the contradictions. If somebody comes up and says that it's 3, then you know that they're lying because there's a contradiction there. Because anytime you take two of some item and put them in front of you, it always equals 2, no matter if some sophist tells you that it doesn't through some ridiculous you know, sophist calculation. We have to remember that the map is not the territory, and just because they can create fancy magic with mathematics doesn't mean that it's telling the truth.
Right.
So,
So,
back to you.
mind control. Mind control, mind control. We are all vulnerable to mind control. And some of the first steps that people take to actually start mind controlling another individual. What are some of the first steps that they take? Do they use flattery? Some people would suggest that that is the first step.
Sure. Well, that's one way to do it. You're going to use the appeal to emotion fallacies, for instance. And so, going back to the list of fallacies there, let me go back to that other page that you just mentioned. It's a little bit easier to follow because it's got some of the prime ones on it right there.
Which page are we on?
That was the, if people on the Trivium Education website, they go to the Trivium menu up at the top and then select the logic dropdown. And then they'll go to the NISCOR logical fallacies page that's by, I just forgot his name. I know the guy that did that page. I've had him on my show, but I'm discussing logical fallacies specifically. But so when we look at the different logical fallacies there, we can see like up there at the top is an appeal to emotion. Mm-hmm. We also have appeal to flattery. You want to butter the person up. Another thing that they'll do is, we did all of this work for you. What are you going to do for us? Give them a sort of a guilt trip type of thing. So then that way they're caught in with it. Diet regulations are always key to mind controlling people. Telling people that you have some secret over others, occultation and getting people to believe that they're a part of a secret club is also key because, occultation is never used for the benefit of all. It's always used to, for one person, for their gain against whoever doesn't have that information. So when we see initiatory organizations like the Masons, et cetera, each level that's occulted from the one below it, they do this specifically for, different levels of control. And so all of these things are sort of implemented together. But, the primary way that all of this stuff works is first and foremost via the trivium and the logical fallacies. Because if you memorize the logical fallacies, for instance, in 40 minutes, most people can learn the gist of the basic 20 or 25 fallacies, and that will protect them from most of the garbage out there if they just memorize those. And, so that is key because if you can begin to seal these appeals to emotion or appeal to religious beliefs and, these sorts of things, then you can see how you're being manipulated in these other areas and stop it or prevent it or get yourself out of it. And so it's constantly, this is why John Taylor Gatto's work is so important because, it's constantly about conditioning the children through the compulsory education system just to accept things as fact by putting logic before grammar and then always going to some authority to get the answer. So you're appealing to authority, either the ad verecundium fallacy, which is, false authority. So rather than simply, trusting yourself to check the citations and see if they're true or not, you say, oh, well, this isn't published in a journal or this isn't written by a doctor or, some ad hominem fallacy to dismiss the work itself because, in such a case, you would lack the self-confidence and the self-esteem to trust your own five senses to just simply go and look for yourself. So you're always left to appeal to others to simply fill in this information when it's a simple matter of who, what, where, and when, which you were taught in second grade.
Right. Is Mr. Gatto ill? He was quite ill.
He had a stroke, and in fact, Richard Grove, my partner that I work with out of Connecticut, he did a series of interviews with him. I interviewed Gatto three times over the last couple of years. And then last year, Gatto suffered a stroke, after they had filmed, after he had filmed a series called The Ultimate History Lesson with Richard Grove.
Oh, right. Wasn't that wonderful?
Yes. And that was, in the audio version of that, I'm one of the people when there's an audio version where every 15 minutes we stop and do commentary on the entire on the entire interview thing. And I'm in there with Richard and Tony Myers and I think Kevin and possibly Lisa and maybe a couple of others in there doing the commentary on that. But, the Ultimate History Lesson, John Taylor Gatto's work, is really key to understanding how they go after the children first is sort of the foundational stuff. And then build it up from there. But so many people are just so trusting in the compulsory education system. And it's not the lower level people that are doing it. They're just willful idiots going along, doing what they think is right and what they're told. And they don't understand the deeper consequences of what they're doing. Because first and foremost, again, they don't have the trivium, which, you know, what brought about the American Revolution was the trivium. The trivium used to be taught in the, you know, often in the single room schoolhouses. And there's a Canadian reporter, she wrote a couple of years ago that she felt that the entire foundation of the War of Independence was, you know, was due to the trivium. And so what did they do? You know, John Dewey and these guys come in, and first thing in the early 1900s is they're pushing out the single room schoolhouse because it was trivium based. You know, what's the best way to learn things is to teach it. And so when you have a room full of kids from, you know, from 5 to 14 years old, the older ones teaching the younger ones, they come out as fully proficient teachers by the time they're done at age 12 and 14. And this is why when you look in the 1800s, you have 12 and 14-year-olds that are capable of running full corporations and, you know, businesses and empires and all of this stuff, because they were trained in these, you know, ways of being able to think and do things critically, whereas, you know, now this has all been dumbed down out of them. It's like, you know, in Judaic culture, they're considered adults at age 13, not 18. Why prolong adolescence, right?
Right. Yes, that is... And again, you have that same group of Freemasonic people, which included the New England Publishing Company, and then they started with William T. Harris, John Dewey, Calvin Stowe, Nicholas Murray Butler, G. Stanley Hall, and those are the people that really kind of reworked the National Education Association and formed a monopoly and incorporated it in 1886 in the District of Columbia. Then it was chartered under Title 36 of the U.S. Code. And then you have the Rockefeller Foundation come in and fund it all, and the monopolization of education for the entire country. And I think...
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just seeing some interesting connections to what you're saying here, because, you know, you're talking about, well, we were just talking about John Dewey. Well, John Dewey was also a member of the Century Club.
Mm-hmm.
So he creates the first Humanist Society of New York, and he's in there actually with Albert Einstein and Sir Julian Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a nice little tie-in right there. And then he also signed into the Humanist Manifesto. And that was also signed by Raymond Bragg and some others in there. I'm going to have to flush that out some more. But interestingly, the Century Club, now up at the Century Club, we also have Dwight Eisenhower there, right? Now,
yes.
I mentioned to you a little bit ago, you know, we were talking about William Engdahl this morning and my conversation with him this morning. So he emails me in the middle of the night last night. It was like midnight. I get a message from him. And he tells me to look up the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. So I start looking it up, doing a background investigation in this. And, of course, it was put into effect by Dwight Eisenhower at the Century Club, right? And
mm-hmm.
So, you know, all of these guys, you know, here we have John Dewey, Dwight Eisenhower, Aldous Huxley, Gordon Wasson, all the people that we've been talking about who were doing all of this stuff, they're all coming, you know, they're all centered right around the Century Club.
Right. Exactly. Let's see here. I'm looking at some notes. And there was also the Century Company, which involved some of these people. Mm-hmm. Just looking at the notes that I took from the book that we mentioned earlier about the Pilgrims Society.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of that, I saw this movie on Netflix a couple of months ago called The Conspirator, like a 50 minutes or something into the movie. And I mentioned it in my Dr. Colin Ross interviews on MKUltra. But halfway through the movie, and it's about the Lincoln assassination, and all of these guys, they go and meet at the Century Club right after the assassination.
Mm-hmm. How handy.
How handy. I was just like, wow. And they just put it right, you know, and it's just like all of a sudden they show like the sign out in front of the Century Club and here's the Century, you know, and it was just, you know, your average viewer wouldn't have any, recognition in what that is. But if you realize that half of this stuff and in these operations and murders and assassinations going on are centered around the Century Club, and that the Bohemian Club is the sister or offshoot group of the Century Club, then it's like, oh, now I really get the bigger picture here.
Sure. And of course, that's where the politicians and the military people met, so that they could collaborate and make their plans. I mean, you have to have the force behind the brains to make all this stuff happen.
Right, exactly. And this is what they show in that film, The Conspirator, as well, that, you know, the military and politicians are meeting up at the Century Club right after right after Lincoln gets shot to decide what they need to do. But obviously, this is the think tank where they actually implement the stuff. I mean, you know, we've got guys like John Maynard Keynes there, John Foster Dulles, we already mentioned John Dewey. James B. Conant is there. Walter Lippmann, another big propagandist, just like Edward Bernays is there. We've got, William Schreier, Vannevar Bush is over there. We have B.H. Friedman, who's another psychedelic scholar, who's there along with Gordon Wasson and Aldous Huxley. And, of course, they're all running the MKUltra project together out of there. You know, but Dwight Eisenhower's connections in there are always interesting, and his stuff just goes into all sorts of rabbit holes from there. You still there? I think your mic is muted or something.
I muted my mic to take a drink of my water, my distilled water with apple cider vinegar in it.
Well, there you go. I have my reverse osmosis water, filter water, and my bulletproof coffee, high fat coffee to go with it.
You know, people like us, we kind of branch out, and it's not just the politics and the stuff around the politicians and the bankers, but you have to branch out and figure out, okay, in as much as they are trying to depopulate the world, we need to also look and see what we're putting in our mouth, what we're eating, what we're drinking. And so we branch out, right?
Indeed. Yes, indeed. And, you know, and so just recently I interviewed David Asprey, the Bulletproof Coffee guy, and I've interviewed Sally Fallon from the Weston A. Price Foundation in the past. I've interviewed Dr. William Davis, the author of Wheat Belly, that exposes how wheat is a poison. And, you know, when you put all of this stuff together, you know, they're telling everybody, eat lots of carbos, eat lots of wheat, don't eat any fat, you know, and we need to put you on Lipitor. Your cholesterol level should be at like 175. When, you know, when we go in and actually look at the research like Fallon has done, we realize that for elderly people, their cholesterol should be between 400 and 1,000. And what we see is, you know, all of this Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all of this stuff starting to come about due to the low fat diet. You know, we don't put crackers in our car to run. We put oil, we put fats in our car,
right.
and people actually think that all this wheat and these carbos are doing them good. But if you go back and study Plato's Republic, he talks about using vegetarianism in there to mind control the population and to lower the population as well,
right?
Because the brain is 77% of what is it, hydroxycholesterol, and which is a base off of cholesterol, and that's the good cholesterol, HDL, and then as is the reproductive system. So, you know, obviously, if you're not getting enough fats in your diet, which they're constantly promoting us, less fat, less fat, less fat, less meat, more veggies, more wheat, you know, and veggies are fine, but it's the wheat and all of the processed foods that you pay the tax to Israel for that are the problem. If you just, you know, buy your food on the outside of the store and stay out of the middle, you don't have to pay that stupid tax, and you get the Whole Foods as well, meaning not the company Whole Foods, but the Whole Foods.
Right, right, right? Got it. I had Pam Colleen on my program today, and she talked a lot about this. And one of the things that she said that I thought was very interesting is that they really started promoting vegetarianism and veganism as a way to depopulate and to destroy a person's ability, the population's ability to reproduce itself.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
You know, Plato made this stuff clear. I mean, just study the philosophy books. It's all right there. Seriously. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's fine. And she mentioned Pottinger's cats. Where by the time you got them into their fourth generation, the cats could not produce. And this doctor did a study on 900 cats, and as long as they were eating raw milk, raw meat, they were fine. You know, the good
Right.
organ meats. But then, as soon as they start into grains and all that other stuff,
Right. Well,
by the fourth generation, they were unable to produce.
it's funny that you just said that, because last night I was just talking to somebody and he's like, "Well, what about my milk? I love my milk." And I'm like, "When you go to the store, stop buying the pasteurized stuff. Just, right next to the pasteurized one, just get the raw one. It's organic also. But it won't give you lactose intolerance because the lactate hasn't been destroyed in it from cooking it, and you're going to get all of the bioflora that you need for your gut and your intestines, and it'll nutrify you. And as far as I know, and I haven't verified this that I recall, but if they feed a baby calf pasteurized milk for about 2 weeks, it dies.
That should tell you something right there. That's just like using microwaved water on your plants. They die.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's just very important that people get whole fresh foods. Stop eating the processed food. Stop eating the vegetable oils. Sally Fallon's work is essential. So is Dave Asprey's, the Bulletproof Coffee guy. The Weston A. Price Foundation, they show the paleo diet and how that works. And then David Asprey's work, he just sort of streamlines a little bit and then shows you, which foods are more inflammatory and which foods are less. So, rather than having a fall off the wagon sort of policy, like if I have one bad thing, he just shows you keep it on a track where you're always focused on lower inflammation foods. And if you mess up, just the rest of the week, eat low inflammation foods. And if you're eating, grains, which almost all of the LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol that people get is from grains and from wheat, so they don't really want people to know this, that what they do is they blame the saturated fats and they tell us the saturated fats have no nutritional value, like this nonsense article in the New York Times that was published recently. And in fact, it was David Asprey who debunked that article. And, but he and Weston A. Price Foundation, and there's a little 24-year-old, Denise Menger, who runs rawfoodsos.com, and she's exposed all of this. She single-handedly debunked the China study, and the guys out of, what was it, Cornell and, Dr. Campbell and this other guy, they totally faked the China study. They omitted wheat and then fudged all of the numbers. And a 23-year-old caught him. Turn on your mic.
Which is what they do in most studies, whether you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry, where they do all the studies on all the pills and stuff that they do, and say, "Oh yeah, we've done the study and it's okay." So the FDA approves it, and people get sick and die. What is it? 900,000 people a year die because of medical intervention.
Right. And then when you get, it's like my stepdad had diabetes, so we put him on, got him off the wheat, put him on a high fat diet. Suddenly, all of this is reversing. My mom had all of these allergy problems for years. Get her off of wheat on a high fat diet, it's all reversing. And it's not just, our family, but over the last few years since having Sally Fallon and Dr. Davis and Dave Asprey on my show. Every single person that has emailed me that has gone to the high fat, low carb diet has reported the same results. Every single person.
Wow. And think of what the allopathic medical doctors want you to do. They want you to take what is the allergy test to see what you're allergic to, and then they want
Sure.
to pump you
Well, sure.
full
And
of these shots every week, and oh my
right.
goodness.
Well, and what they do is, they want to test you for, if you're allergic to wheat, but even if you have the allergy to wheat, the celiac disease, this does not account for all of the LDL cholesterol in it, how it causes obesity, how it causes diabetes, how it causes acne and inflammation and arthritis and all of these other things. So, not only are you not getting enough fats, and this is why it causes all the joint problems and stuff, but these when they look for an allergy with wheat, it dismisses all of this other stuff. I mean, the LDL cholesterol is what builds up in our arteries and causes heart attacks, along with the the vegetable oils that they sell, and it's not the saturated fats. And, you know, it's, you know, the Dr. Davis, in fact, he's a cardiologist.
Right. Yeah. He's up in Wisconsin. I have his book.
Yes. It's an excellent book. And for over 4 years now, you know, when patients come to him, he makes them sign an agreement that, they're not allowed to eat wheat for 3 months before their operation for their heart surgery.
Oh, and right. So, yes. I read that.
Right. And he hasn't done an operation in over 4 years because by surgery day, all of their systems are clear just from not eating wheat.
That is amazing.
You know, and so, you know, just because you don't have celiac disease, which, you know, and the diarrhea and IBS type symptoms, you know, doctors say IBS because they're just bullshitting you because they don't know, you know, it's like, I'm BSing you.
Mm-hmm.
IBS, you know, instead right. of saying that, you know, you have wheat intolerance and it's, you know, grains and these things cause these problems. So
of course they have a certain protocol, a certain thing that they're supposed to do. They have
they
the
give
handbook.
You drugs.
Yes, they have the handbook, and it doesn't matter which gastroenterologist you go to, they're all going to say the very exact same thing because that's the protocol. And if you actually are a doctor and you want to help your patient, if you go against that protocol, you lose your license and all kinds of nasty things happen to you. And so when people have big school loans that they have to pay off, they are compelled to go along with that protocol in order to pay off the loans, to have the lifestyle that their spouse thinks that they're entitled to. So they're really caught between a hard rock and a rock and a hard spot.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah, well, you know, speaking of all of that, I had to go out of the country after 12 allopathic doctors here. I finally, in 2009, I went down to Peru and I was treated by Dr. Ortiz down there at the Arequipa Private Hospital. And so he was able to finally cure two of the three problems. He did not recognize the celiac. And I asked him, he's like, oh, you know, only 10% of the population gets that. But he actually used terms that I had never heard before in American hospitals. And Dr. Ortiz was actually trained. He came up to study at Harvard for 2 weeks a year. And so here's this Harvard trained doctor who gets updated every year at Harvard. And he's actually using words like cure. You know, I can cure this. I can cure that. And I'm like, wait. Dr. Ortiz, can you repeat that? Because in America, it's illegal for doctors to say cure. Did you just say cure? You said, oh, yeah, I can cure that. No problem.
Well, that is interesting. And he practices where?
He's in the private hospital in Arequipa, Peru. He's a gastroenterologist there.
Right. He could not practice in this country.
Right. And yeah, but he studies here. But, you know, he is a Peruvian. So, but, right. You know, for people who want his information, he's at the... And I know a lot of people who start listening to celiac and stomach problems, but he's Dr. Carlos Ortiz at the Arequipa Private Hospital in downtown Arequipa in Peru.
Can I be personal and ask what you had?
Well, I had a rare form of H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori in my stomach. I forget the other one that they found in my small intestine. And then on top of those two, I also had celiac disease. So three different things going off simultaneously.
Wow.
And I was in and out of the hospitals from the time I was 25 until the time I was 39, more than 40 times.
Oh, my goodness. Was it usually diarrhea or?
Oh, yeah. You know, diarrhea, vomiting. I would go on bouts of vomiting that would go on nonstop for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, that sort of thing.
Wow. And you'd become emaciated and.
Right. Yeah. Like when I left the hospital in Peru, I was at 114 pounds and I am now at 163.
And you're tall?
I'm about 5'10", 5'10 and a half. And
okay.
So I've gained 49 pounds since I left the hospital. And I'm not fat at all.
Wow. And that was caused basically by you ingesting wheat and wheat products.
Wheat and wheat products. Some of it was I had picked up a bacteria when I had lived in Serbia during the war with my ex-wife. The Americans were bombing the water treatment facilities and things like that. So I picked up something over there.
What was that called?
That was probably the H. pylori. And then they treated it in the hospital once there, and then I got it back probably another time when I was in Europe. And then,
of course, they treat it with antibiotics, and antibiotics really don't kill anything.
Well, you know, I went to... before I went to Peru, I actually went to a naturopath here in California, and he was actually the only one that figured out what was going on. And he said, here's what's going on, but because I'm a naturopath, I can't treat you. These are the antibiotics that you need. So take this to your other doctor, you know, take this to the allopath and get this treatment. So he went as far as he could with all natural treatments to kill off the parasites like the H. pylori without medicines, and then said, you know what, we have to stop here, and then and from here we have to go to the antibiotics. So at the hospital in Peru, what they did was to kill the two severe ones, you know, they had to put me on these just outrageous antibiotics, and finally after 2 weeks it finally killed them.
Like what, they put you on Flagyl and Levaquin or something like that?
Oh, I don't remember. They were like horse pills, you know, they were just awful, you know, and gave me a migraine headache for 2 weeks while I was, you know, trying to gain weight at the same time. But I haven't had the pain and all that, you know, kept me down and out repeatedly,
right,
near, you know, not even 10% as much as it used to be.
Wow. Now, your headaches may have been die-off effect.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, there's that, and then there's the dehydration and all of that sort of stuff that goes along with it. Because, you know, when you're down at 114, 115 pounds and you're going between Arequipa and Cusco, you know, and Cusco is a, you know, little city at 11,000 feet. You know, half of this country is just way the hell up there. So.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's quite a miracle that you're alive.
Yeah, well, you know, I wasn't supposed to be.
Right. So did they attempt to kill you before you started your investigation or after?
Before? Oh, you know, I can't, certainly couldn't tie the two, but, you know, that's funny. But, you know, it's funny because when I was living in Yugoslavia, I was very much into investigating the whole war there and all of the lies in the American media and how they drummed everything up to get the Americans riled up against Yugoslavia and the Serbs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and meanwhile, half the stuff going on was false flag operations against the Serbs. And, you know, we had these, you know, old Ustasha and Hanjar divisions that, you know, had massacred thousands of Serbs working together with the U.S. and Germany and stuff, PR and the whole thing. And it was a big mess. But, you know, it was certainly, you know, it was then that I really started waking up to American foreign policy and, you know, what we see in the mainstream news isn't so real. But, you know, for years before that, I had already been collecting alternative news archives and had worked with Jeannie Brittingham Erstedt, who was She Who Remembers. She died in April 2002, but she's really the one that got me into research. And she had her own radio show. And, you know, I first came on her radio show, and she was really the one that got me into doing all of this type of work.
Now, what did she pass away from?
She died of lung failure. She was a chain smoker and also had her house had a black mold infestation as well. She, you know, she would not keep the house real clean and had too many cats and dogs that went on the carpet and things like that. And I think all of that exacerbated the problem.
Oh, absolutely. Wow.
So
that's too bad.
Yep, indeed it is. So, you know, but, you know, on my website, we still have, you know, 500 hours of her archives available there. And unfortunately, a lot of the Terrence McKenna stuff and whatnot came out of those archives. But at least now today, we have all of the information to follow up on that and show people how it was mind control. I'm not going to remove it since it's her archives and they're all a whole. But, you know, we are putting out the information to show how, you know, some of the stuff in those archives was false.
Alrighty, GnosticMedia.com. You have a lot of stuff here. Where would we find? What? Tell us about your website. Give us a little description, and you know, tell us where to go here.
All right. Well, GnosticMedia.com. That's a good question. All right. So the up at the top right, or on the top on the front page at GnosticMedia.com, you'll see the Secret History of Magic Mushrooms there in red.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see my article that I wrote last year on Wasson there, as well as my article on Huxley and Darwin and McKenna there. The down below there on the front page, you'll see like you down there, our interview from a couple of weeks ago. Those are the latest my latest podcast interviews, as well as a lot of other interviews that I've done recently. I'll repost them on my show. I don't do all of them because it gets overwhelming and then people can't find my recent shows as well. Up there on the top is the blue icon up there on the top of the website that says Brain Database. That's the database that we use for research, and people can download a full copy of that. We put out a new, you know, one with the updated research every month or two or so for people to get, you know, so that way they can see exactly where the research is coming from, check our citations, go through everything. And then if anything ever happens to any of us, you know, then there's 10,000 people out there who can pick up where we left off tomorrow.
Exactly.
And
you have,
you know,
a,
so that's
a
the,
members area. What's a members
yeah.
area?
Well, the members area, what we do is to help keep the research going and pay for the show and everything. We allow everybody to download the new episodes for free for 3 months. And then after that, it goes to the members area, and then it's just for paying members only. But, you know, you get an account and up to five, you know, four of your friends, and you can use one login account or, you know, five IP addresses. So that's just the members area helps fund our research and keep things going, and people can, you know, there's not a whole lot to participate in there other than comments on the shows and whatnot. But that's the gist of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see you had Freeman Bird on. Isn't he terrific?
Yeah, I've had Freeman Bird on three times, and I think, I talked to him last night. We're supposed to do another show any day, and I think he did your show last week. And
mm-hmm.
So, you know, and he's one of Clint's friends, and you're one of Clint's friends, and so that's how that's all been working. So so it goes back and forth between you and I, apparently. Apparently, you're like the other radio program that Clint had been cheating with, you know, for years, so... You know, I find out this whole thing is going on. I'm like, oh, it's Deanna. That's the one. Oh, I get it now. And she was in my list to interview like 2 years ago. And then it's all, you know, coming for full circle here.
Right. Funny.
So.
Funny.
Anyway.
Clint was one of the first people that I found right after I began my radio program back in October of 2010. That was the first time that I'd watched the Corporation Nation, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to get a hold of this guy. And it was kind of hard to find an email for him, but I finally did, and he's just been a favorite ever since then.
Yeah, I've had him on my show, I think, seven times now, maybe eight.
Oh, uh-huh.
Too many, Clint.
I won't tell you how many times I've had him on. I think... I don't know, maybe 30 or 35 times.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, see, there it is, you know. But, you know, it's, you know, I like having him on a lot because he does a lot of primary research and he can go to actual documents and details.
Oh, that's what I love
them, you know?
About him. I just
and,
love that
and
about
that's
him.
What, and that's what so many people hate about him and us as well. I'm sure you get the same thing because when you cite primary citations and things, they can't deal with the information, so they have to attack you, you know.
Right. Or they say, oh, no, somebody else said it happened this way. So, and whatever they hear first, they're going to promote. They're going to believe. And that is, when people are being brainwashed, it's what they hear first that they will remember and repeat. And it
right.
doesn't matter if there's a revision of what the event actually was. They're going to remember what they heard first. Oh, no, it was those 19 Arabs that did that.
Okay, so when did you interview Clint first? Let's get this down to chronology here.
Okay, let's see. When did I interview Clint first? I will have to go to my page and my radio schedule. And 2010, when did I interview? 2010 guests. I interviewed him first, and there's some people that I interviewed right in the first 3 months that I actually, speaking of William Engdahl, I interviewed him on December 10th of 2010 was the first time that I interviewed him. And I interviewed Clint the very, very first time on December 15th of 2010.
Oh, you beat me by 5 weeks. How about that?
And I had him on the next day. I only had an hour program, and he was so intriguing, I had him on the next day.
Yeah. I had him on the first time January 22nd, 2000, or no, well, it was recorded January 18th, 2011, so.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And that was back in the day when Edgar Steele was still, well, just after he'd gotten arrested, and what a terrible thing that was. The frame up of Edgar Steele.
I guess maybe I don't know about that. You want to enlighten me? I'm ignorant.
He was a lawyer. He still is a lawyer, but he is currently in jail. And the CIA, a couple of CIA agents, FBI, no, I think it was the FBI. Yeah, it was the FBI, set him up and claimed that he had attempted to kill his wife, murder his wife. And they found, she took her car to the garage for maintenance, and they found a bomb under her car that was put there by the FBI. And he used to put out something called the Nickel Rant. And he was doing kind of the same thing that you're doing. It was just educating people. And so apparently he got too close to certain pieces or types of information, and so they silenced him and accused him of doing this attempting to murder his wife and his mother-in-law, and he's in jail.
Wow.
And I had his attorney Wesley W. Hoyt on, and his wife Cindy Steele, and that was actually that just before that I interviewed Gilead Osmond.
Oh, interesting. I've had him on too. So, did his wife say that it was all a setup as well?
Oh, absolutely,
So,
absolutely. She knew that was all set up, and
So they, even though she didn't claim that he had tried to murder her, they claimed it and then incarcerated him under their own false pretenses.
And they doctored documents, they doctored audio tapes, they pieced audio tapes together. It was terrible, terrible thing that they did.
Wow, that sounds like he needs Bert's help, huh?
He needs somebody's help.
Well, if you haven't mentioned Bert that direction, maybe you ought to.
I talked to Cindy. I emailed her maybe 3 weeks ago, and I asked her what was going on. And of course, her husband is still in the in jail. And I don't want to say anything about his attorney, but if you're using a regular attorney,
Well, he's sworn to the court.
He was working for the court. He's working for the Bar Association. He's a foreign agent. I kind of got into it a little bit with his attorney on another matter. He called me up after a program one day and said, "Oh, you can't be denying the Holocaust." And I said, "And why is that?" So we've not spoken since then. Except,
Yeah, well,
yeah.
you don't want to question things that there's no evidence for, because that would
Exactly.
be.
And he also represented David Hinkson, who is the son of Roland Hinkson. And it
I
turns
don't know
out,
those two.
okay, David Hinkson developed some I'm not sure exactly a way to enhance water so that it was really good for you, take out all of the the bad stuff. And an FBI guy who's dead now decided that that looked like a pretty good operation. So they framed David Hinkson. And he is in jail for something like 39 years. Now, what do you have to do to get yourself in jail for 39 years? Or however long they put him away for. I mean,
Tell me.
that is pretty awful. Let's see. Let me just bring up Roland's information here. If you went to RolandHinksonFiles.com, Hinkson is Hinkson, and he wrote A Cesspool of Judicial Corruption, The David Hinkson Story. And you can read it at his website. And it tells about how they set him up in order for this FBI guy who's dead, who died recently in the last year, so that this guy could take over his operation, and so that they could also shut down this wonderful company that was helping and benefiting so many people.
Well, nothing new there. You know, it's, if the government was out of everybody's business, could you imagine where humanity would be now?
Oh,
and it's like yesterday I found this video of this guy who took pictures of outer space from a homemade model rocket. And I'm like going, wait, so, you know, he took a couple of, he took three GoPro cameras, put them on a model rocket, and launched a model rocket into outer space and took NASA quality photos of the planet.
Oh my. Amazing.
You know, it's just, you know, and it's like, what? You know, and you know, and recently there was this guy who did the same thing. He put a GoPro camera on a weather balloon and put it way up in the sky, and so the CIA contacts him and the, or NASA contacts him because for 500 pounds, he had taken better photos than NASA had gotten, spending, you know, tens of millions of dollars trying to do the same thing.
Indeed. And of course, those tens of billions of dollars went into a certain corporation's bottom line.
Exactly. Exactly. Whereas, you know, it's like these backyard scientists are making rockets that can hit 23 miles up.
Exactly.
And not only that, he got the pictures of outer space and the rocket came back and he picked it up off the floor of the desert, got his cameras out of it, and published the whole damn thing online.
Amazing. Amazing. Oh,
so,
my goodness.
You know.
Well, back in that first 3 months, I interviewed Michael Hoffman about Talmudic occupation. I interviewed Michael Murphy, who had just come out with What in the World Are They Spraying?
Sure, I've interviewed him, and I've got the other one's book, The Judaic Deception or something like that. Big 1,000-page book, yes.
Oh, it's amazing. It is amazing.
I haven't gotten to it yet. It's on my list. I did buy it, though. It was $100, and that was the cheap copy I found.
Wow. And I interviewed Gordon Duff, and I don't think I interviewed him, let's see. Oh, maybe three times. And then I thought, I did never interview him after 2010, I don't think. But I did meet during that time. There was a gentleman, Matthew O'Brien, who did a wonderful, wonderful article called The Homeless Living in the Tunnels Under the Strip in Las Vegas. And it was an absolutely amazing article. He ended up doing a book called, let's see, My Week at the Blue Angel, in which he discussed someone. He discussed a woman, a young woman, Jessie Foster, who was probably the victim of sexual trafficking. Human trafficking. And from that book, I ended up interviewing her mother. And I had her mother on just recently. And her name is Glendine Grant. And I had her on the first time on December 30th. And she is an amazing, amazing woman. And she is the mother of Jessie Foster. And I had her on... let's see, the 9th of May, I believe, which was, no, the 27th of May. And I had her on because it was Jessie's birthday. And she's still missing. She's been missing for 7 years. So there's so many personal stories that you run into when you're dealing with corruption, when you're dealing with an overall horrible, horrible situation like human trafficking, that you run into the individual stories that really bring home the suffering that people experience. Whether you're talking about a person that is a victim of the allopathic industry, or whether you're talking about a victim that is that from human trafficking or whatever you're talking about, there's all those personal stories that bring it home, that make you really have empathy for other people. And I guess you can compare it to what Stalin said. He said, "Oh, well, when you're talking about one death, yes, that's really a big deal. But when you're talking about 50 million, then it's just a figure. It's just a statistic." So I like doing the stories where you talk to just one person, and you understand what happened in their life to their family, and how it's impacted them. I get emotional when I talk about this stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, it's tough, and that's the thing is these people don't seem to have any ethics, and they want us to believe that there is no morality in the world, and there is no right and wrong, and no natural law, and all of this stuff, so that they can go about doing these things that they do against others that that they can go off and feel good about later. You know, it's like. It's like this, you know, going back to our subject of MK Ultra earlier and the WASS and investigation and all of this current stuff that we've been looking in. This guy sent me some documents that he discovered and published in the 90s. You know, he's a professor out of Asia, American professor. But, this letter is from to Al Hubbard, who is one of the key MK Ultra guys. And it says, quote, "Our investigations of some of the current social movements affecting education indicate that the drug usage prevalent among student members of the new left is not entirely undesigned. Some of it appears to be present as a deliberate weapon aimed at political change." And this is the kind of stuff that they're just doing on every level. They're going after the kids in the universities, getting them drugged up, whether it's, prostitution and whatnot. And, Richard Grove has been investigating that reporter that turned up missing for reporting the pedophilia stuff and the Bilderberg conference in England this year going on. I don't know that guy's name, but, there's a story behind all of that as well. And that guy has been disappeared all of a sudden.
Yikes.
Yeah, and that's just the recent one.
Wow. I've got a couple of guests on this week that are going to talk about pedophilia. And one of them, David Schurter.
Wrote Who is a book. That?
David Schurter wrote a book about it.
And right. Well, essentially what's going on is, do you remember that film Conspiracy of Silence? That exposed the pedophilia going up into the Bush White House, Bush White House, and all of that.
Yes,
and it was pulled from, it was supposedly pulled from HBO or something right before it aired. But so supposedly that is still ongoing, and it's just a smaller part of the picture. But apparently, the host company of these big Bilderberg conferences picks up the tab on all of the entertainment for the guests, which includes guess what?
Yeah.
So this is the story that this guy who just disappeared was covering.
Well, they don't like those things to get out.
You mean you got to take somebody's innocence away to control them and to also keep your partner in secret so that he keeps all of your secrets and you keep his secrets and you all sit around and you rape somebody or murder somebody or commit pedophilia against a little kid so that you can all have your little rah-rah secret club and your little secrets and go do your little evil against the world. I mean, yeah, that's
well,
how they,
that
that's
how
they
how
keep
they
everybody
them.
In line.
Sure.
Well, that's exact. That's mm-hmm. what I'm getting at. That's how you keep them all in line and keep them, these Skull and Bones and all these guys, they all have their little pedophilia rituals that they go through, that's what,
yes.
what keeps them in there.
And that is especially true in places like Hollywood.
Right. Well, and this guy that was exposing all of this was supposedly uncovering all of this stuff with Johnny Depp and these other guys that were involved in some pedophilia ring in childhood. And then I guess if you live through it, then they make you a big star when you're older.
Yes. Wow. No wonder some of these stars have such problems.
So, if you or I disappear this week, or you and I disappear this week, or next,
Oh,
So,
goodness.
and I'm not, Rich told me not to quote him, so I'm not quoting him. I'm just paraphrasing what I recall from some of the research that was sent this way. So I don't even remember the guy's name. I could be just completely full of crap because I can't remember the guy's name. I'd actually have to go do grammar and look up the email and the name and everything. So maybe I shouldn't, and spare all of your listeners getting, disappeared by the CIA too.
Right.
Let me see. So what was his name? Forget that. Let's just go.
Have you ever interviewed the gentleman that wrote the Franklin cover-up, DeCamp?
I have not, no.
I mean, I can barely read that book. Every time I pick it up to think, okay, I'm going to read this book, I can't read the book. It just seems too unbelievable that people would do the things that I know are in that book.
Right. Well, I
So.
haven't seen the book, so I'll have to. It sounds like another rabbit hole, and there's just so much disturbing stuff down the Alfred Kinsey pedophile hole and
Oh.
all that. It's
Yeah.
just one of the another nightmare, that these people trying to justify their actions and violation against other human beings, and
And again, the same names come up. Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Foundation, same people come up when you're talking about Kinsey.
yep, man. I've got Kinsey in the database as well, and I got him at Harvard, influenced by Rockefeller Foundation, Indiana University, Aleister Crowley,
Aldous Huxley and Julian.
right? And so right,
He was a big
and
proponent of the Huxleys.
was he really? Yeah, that
Yeah.
doesn't surprise me at all. So I'll have to get, there's another thing I need to have you put in here. So sexual revolution, and then that goes over to Margaret Mead, whose husband was Gregory Bateson, who was one of the key MK Ultra researchers, and of course both Jewish. And then they fell. Then Wilhelm Reich gets into that same line of research. Now, interestingly, they're all following Bronislaw Malinowski, who comes out of the University of Leipzig, and he's one of the ones who creates this compulsory education system to dumb the kids down and all this kind of stuff. But it goes from Bronislaw Malinowski out to Margaret Mead and Wilhelm Reich. Now, they lock Wilhelm Reich up. I don't know, how much of this he was promoting was wrong. A serious study of his work needs to go into too, but they locked him up in jail where he died at the end, and he had come ag out against his own teacher, Sigmund Freud. And even in The Century of the Self, I think in part four, they just completely blast Wilhelm Reich and the things that he said against Freud, trying to stop what they were doing with the Oedipus complex and probably in the social control and whatnot. And so, go over to Margaret Mead here. We get she was at the Macy conferences with Gregory Bateson. The Macy conferences are where of course, that's where MK Ultra came out of. Was the Macy conferences. So she was actually there, and she was a key person behind the sexual revolution and coming age of Samoa, National Research Council she's a part of. And let me see, she does something Never Doubt. I'm gonna have to look up more on that. I just have a note here for it. Tied in with Norbert Wiener. Norbert Wiener, of course, MIT, back at the Macy conferences, also developed cybernetics, which is a huge thing, a part of this control. He was also friends with Gregory Bateson. He was also tied in with I.A. Richards, who is the guy who created the dumbed down General Basic English Dictionary, which like with like 100 or 850 basic English words that everybody was going to use. That was him. And then he heavily influenced Bertrand Russell and Eric Trist and Marshall McLuhan, who in turn influenced Terence McKenna and Timothy Leary, et cetera. So it's a really tight little circle of these clowns.
And then,
There's Rudyard Kipling there. I mean, boy, that guy,
oh, he
Gods of
was
the
bad.
talk about a racist,
Oh,
son of a
terrible.
eugenist.
Terrible
But
guy.
he was Rudyard Kipling is hanging out with Cecil Rhodes, who of course is the godfather of the Rhodes Trust and the Rhodes Scholars and all of that nonsense. So then Kipling used to hang out with him at his ranch in Africa, and Kipling wrote Gods of the Copybook Heading, which has You know, that's where actually Aldous Huxley got the title of his book, Brave New World. It builds reflexive reactions, not responsive, born of the critical analysis of the stimulus. Aldous Huxley, who paid homage to both Shakespeare and Kipling in the title of his book, Brave New World, explained how sleep learning had proved useless for teaching new skills, requiring constant thought, etc. And then there's also The Burden of Jerusalem, which gets right back into... Winston Churchill and all of these guys, all of the personal letters that they were sending between them. But, you know, the Burden of Jerusalem is really just one of the most racist, disturbing, you know, this guy was a sociopath. He was very seriously psychologically disturbed, and he's really, you know, representative of all of these guys, you know, like Cecil Rhodes and Wasson and Alan Dulles and all of these guys at the Century Club, you know, that are, and the CIA for that matter, that are doing all of this stuff.
Right. Even getting back to Kinsey, the Playboy Foundation actually supported the Kinsey Institute.
Sure.
And Hefner came out with a book called Playboy in 1953, which is the same time that Kinsey came out with, he wrote two books, one for male and one for female. And I believe that is the one about the females came out in 53. And you can just see the degeneration, the cultural degeneration of our society since that time, which actually started back in the 20s when all of
I mean, it started even before then, too. I mean...
But when you had
Attacking Germany with this stuff in the 1880s, 1890s, you know.
But then you had all the people from the Weimar Republic who were being kicked out in 1933 come over here. And that is when you had the first, I believe it was the first film that showed a naked woman. Hedy Lamarr was in a film in 1933. And she was Jewish. She came over here from Austria. And can't remember the film, the name of Ecstasy in 1933. And so then you had all of the, and then she signed up with one of the Louis B. Mayer and made several other films. She's married six times, but she brought that Weimar mentality over here. And it's been pretty much going downhill since then.
Sure. And then, you know, from my article, Manufacturing the Deadhead, then, you know, Bernays picks up the performances of Vaslav Nijinsky, who mimed on stage masturbation, causing riots and whatnot. And then, they're, you know, so they're intentionally promoting all of this stuff into society. And then, of course, you know, like we read in the article, tying it back to Jim Morrison of The Doors and his promotion of the Oedipus Complex on... in his song, The End, and also, you know, just talking about how all of the children are insane and, you know, and he's doing these very same miming masturbation techniques on stage and everything as these others.
Right. Gosh. I can't imagine, well, doing these things in such a public arena.
Well, you know, that's the idea, is they're trying to debase society.
Shock.
You know, so, you know, they know that it's sex. And see, because if you can get people to start having wild sex and break apart the family unit, then people are going to be reliant on the social programs. You got to remember, these are the Fabian socialists. They're trying to sell socialism. They want everybody on the government tit, right?
Right.
So, you know, if they can get people to break away from the family, and if they can destroy culture, they're always, you know, Terrence McKenna was always talking about, you know, attacking culture. We have to destroy the culture to survive. Well, if you destroy culture, what that is, that's really your family unit.
Sure.
And your system of support, your food supply, and all of that stuff. So, you know, they bring us all into cities, get us moved away from the traditional food supply and the family support unit, where it's uncles, cousins, grandmothers, you know, the whole bit, all in one place. And then, you know, so then you have single moms who are not ever going to retaliate against the government because they're getting their, you know, their welfare check from the government, right? And then all of the people are moved in the cities, so then they have to rely on the factory farms, on the fluoride in the water, et cetera. So you just hit them constantly from all of these different angles to break down the society as a whole, right? And so just selling the the whole sex, you know, sex into society is just a way, you know, like in Brave New World in Aldous Huxley's book, that's what they want to do. Have everybody just having wild, loose sex all the time so that there is never any chance for, you know, strong relationships and family units to build up.
How true. How true. And of course you have it. I hardly ever watch a movie. I haven't been, I can't tell you how long it's been since I've been to a movie. I do know that in just in every movie you have a sex scene, and it's just and people just kind of accept it, and
it all goes back to this conditioning right here.
Yes.
It just makes you step back and realize, whoa, yeah, you know. And when I started realizing it, you know, it's just when once you see it all, it's just like, man, really? All of these different things that, you know, and some of them you think you enjoy, and then you realize it's all just social conditioning to get you not to reproduce. And if you do, to not have a strong, large family, you know. And then, you know, you go back further, like in World War One, World War Two times, and these HUD homes and all this stuff. And I forget where when it was, and maybe it was John Taylor Gatto who brought this up, but they would actually prevent families, you know, large families from getting loans to buy homes in the U.S. originally, so that, you know, you could only have the nuclear family, the parents and the children. You couldn't have the extended family, the grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. And so this was another way that they were, you know, focused on destroying that strong family unit, because, you know, obviously when you have all your aunts, uncles, cousins there, you know, whoever needs to babysit, you can leave work, whatever, all the time, and the whole rest of the family is there all the time, right? So this is all, you know, just geared towards attacking and breaking that down. And they even did it through home loans and things like that. So, you know, it's, you go to South America or Mexico or Europe, they all still have, you know, these large extended families and aunts and uncles and everything still being around is still very common. And then, you know, all you have in America is all of this rhetoric on the news about family values. But meanwhile, it's long been destroyed.
Oh, right.
Well, you know, not entirely. I should say that, you know, there are still certainly strong family units, but they're always constantly attacking and trying to, you know, attack them mentally using vegetarianism and all of these different things. They're going to get you with fluoride in your water. They're going to get you with something to try and dumb you down, you know. And it's like I spent 12 years being a vegetarian, and that's part of the big reason why I was in and out of the hospital, aside from the bacteria, was the vegetarianism and the wheat.
Oh, right. And of course, the other thing too, in conjunction with the family situation, is that they want to make the school, the compulsory school system, the apparatus, they have all of these other programs, the sports programs. So, and then you have the Boy Scouts, and you have other activities, so that a lot of families don't even eat dinner anymore together.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you know, and that's something that, you know, I have a son who's going to be 7 in a couple of weeks here, you know. And that's one thing that we always do, is we always eat at the table and always have real family meals and discussions and things like that. So, you know, and but he's, you know, he's becoming aware of a lot of this stuff. So it's good that he's not just completely ignorant, like, you know, some of the members on other members of his side of the family.
Right. And even the Boy Scouts. Now my son was in Boy Scouts, but I wouldn't have him in Boy Scouts now, if I had it to do over again, because basically what they teach you is to wear a uniform, to be proud of a uniform, and to do things in order to get those badges, those merit badges, and to put all these badges on this uniform, and they teach you to be patriotic and obedient.
Right.
And
that
is a bad, bad thing to do, because you're teaching them to work as a unit.
My ex was actually upset with me this week, because I've told my son that he shouldn't trust all police officers after they kicked in my friend's house and stole my friend's son, a 12-year-old boy, at gunpoint in the middle of the night. Days before, for tagging on a couple of boxes, which he had already admitted and was already scheduled for trial for it, in another 2 days, and they did a full raid on this house with SWAT and everything over a 12-year-old boy in an upper class family, and a very, you know, good, tight, close family, studying the Trivium and all of our kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
And they haul this kid off at gunpoint in the middle of the night, and then they still continue to raid the house, even though the warrant was for the kid and everything. For another 5 hours, they kept him at gunpoint. So,
Oh my gosh.
You know, I'm waiting for Bert to give the signal for when we can do a nice show about all of this.
Right. And that's what you learn in Boy Scouts, is to be obedient and to work as a unit. And it's an early training environment to join the military and go off and kill people that have never done anything to you.
Yeah, well, for the corporate, you know, structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I'm not against self-defense at all. I'm against going and murdering people for, you know, corporations and
sure.
Israel.
Sure. No, I believe in
self-defense. Let's
get
all the boys, you know, and what it's all about is just getting the boys in the ditches to kill themselves off.
Sure.
You know, that's really, it's just population control, more eugenics. You know, they continue the war as long as possible, as long as the people will put up with it, so that they can just get the males in the ditches to kill themselves off.
Right.
You know, it's like deer hunting season. Go out and shoot all the bucks, right?
Right. And if they don't get them that way, then when they get home, they've pumped them full of all these vaccines. They come home with all of these dreaded diseases and all kinds of other things. And
Wolf Warrior Syndrome.
Right. Post-traumatic stress disorder. And they either take drugs or do a lot of drinking. People are not designed to do what they ask the military to do. They're just
well,
not.
Sure. Well, sure. And, you know, that's the whole thing is, you know, people have to step outside themselves and justify it all by, well, I was following orders to even do all of that
sure.
stuff. You know? And that's the whole conditioning that they put them through, starting with compulsory education and saluting the flag as kids, you know.
Right. Yep. Because that flag that you're saluting, that represents the U.S. government. So basically what you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to be obedient to the U.S. government.
Yep.
And of course, they couple that with all of these songs. And music has the power to touch the heart, to touch the
right.
soul. And whether you're talking rock music, whether you're talking heavy metal or whatever, it has the ability to do something to your emotions.
And they know that.
Yes, they do.
Well, and that's why they've kept everybody in this 60s, early 70s rock phase for the last 50 damn years now, you know. You turn on any damn radio, you know, every time I turn on the radio, it's the same damn music over and over and over. It's like mm-hmm. a half a century now. Can we get on and pass the MK Ultra Laurel Canyon music, folks? I mean, Dave McGowan has already exposed all of this. We're done with it. Get over it. Let's go on.
How true.
You know, come on, folks. You know, he's exposed it. We've exposed it. You know, you've exposed it. I mean, let's get on and be done with it. I would like to hear some new talent out there. You know, is there any?
But people are still, they are still so indoctrinated by it. They still, it still works. And that's why they continue to use it. And there's an insufficient number of people who know what is behind it. Certainly, with Dave's book and with your exposure of it, but that just touches what a small percentage of the people.
Indeed.
So it is unfortunate.
Well, Deanna, I'm getting exhausted. I've been on the phone for almost
Indeed.
4.5 hours straight now.
I am getting hungry. I've run out of water. So
I still have my bulletproof coffee. It's still got me going here, but you got to try that if you haven't yet.
I really don't drink coffee.
Well, this isn't like coffee. It's more to get your fats in your diet each morning.
But, I ate a lot of butter. I made an omelet this morning with a lot of cheese and a couple tablespoons of butter.
Well, this is more like 4 ounces of butter to start your day.
Oh, yum.
Yep. That's what I do every morning.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of commonality here. And that's good.
Indeed.
It's good to have commonality with people who are smart.
Indeed. And who don't mind fact-checking stuff and standing up, you know, to get other people to, hey, you know, it's like, oh, you know, there's so many truths out there. No, here's the document. Just read it. Can you agree
yes.
what this says? Do you know what the word and is and the word the and the word dog, you know?
Yes, indeed. Well, it has been lovely visiting with you, and we'll have to do this again.
Indeed, Deanna, and I'd be happy to, and we'll have to have you on my show sometime. I'll have to put you on the hot seat for a while.
All righty. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. So now, are we actually hanging
Yes, we are actually hanging up. Let me turn off.
up?